What I'm going to try and demonstrate, or suggest, and hopefully demonstrate in the next half hour, is that the church did have a transformative influence on the landscape through the application and spread of various technologies. Probably the most fundamental one, of course, is the mechanization of milling and the use of water power. It's hard to underestimate the contribution of a mechanical mill made to society. The actual mechanization of food production, of food preparation, immense agricultural revolution. In Ireland, seems to have appeared 5th century. We don't know from where, we assume it came from sub-Roman Britain. But the big transformative thing meant that rather than using a quern, a hand tool, one could mechanically mill large amounts of grain. And for institutions like monasteries, and I suppose royal courts, etc., one could feed a lot of people their daily bread. The contrast between the two is immense. Now, traditionally, there's quite a gender bias going, because traditionally, the handling of the hand quern was done by women. Terribly laborious process. They had to probably all day go like this. Must have fantastic arms. The lovely romantic story, but the introduction of the water mill to Ireland is supposed to come at MacArthur, one of our semi-mythical high kings, Tara, 4th century-ish, in love with this quern maiden. She was pregnant. He felt really sorry for her going like this all day. Sent abroad, sourced a millwright, came to Ireland, built the first mill at Tara, and we think we know the site of the first mill. Whether it's true or not, it's a lovely story. Now, we Irish have become a bit insufferable about our mills, because we have the biggest number of firmly dated early medieval mills in Europe. This is our list. This is only the list of the ones that are firmly dated by dendrochronology. A lot of interesting points here, very briefly mentioned. First, thanks to the work of Colin Rinn, he demonstrated that from the very, very beginning, early 7th century, we had both the horizontal mill and the vertical mill. Previous to that, we thought we'd only the horizontal mill, and we had to wait till the Anglo-Normans came and the continental religious orders, so that's not true. The other big point is that from the very beginning, we had not only freshwater mills, but we had the use of tidal power, which is tremendous technological innovation in itself, much more dependable than freshwater. Freshwater mills up until the 19th century, most rural areas went dry for 6 weeks during the summer, tides twice a day. Interesting chronologically in that it seems we reached a peak in Ireland in the late 8th, early 9th century, where a peak of construction of mills. So this would seem to indicate, and it matches paleoecological information, etc., that we reached a height of arable production in Ireland. And then we swing back, maybe a slight more pastoral basis. But I think that denotes a high point in Irish monastic achievement or settlement, an influence on the landscape. Quick introduction to horizontal mill. The name comes from the fact that the mill is set horizontally as opposed to the vertical mill. This is a simplification of the second mill at Nendrum. Why? We have a strong archaeological bias to why there's so many in Ireland, and we're still discovering them. It's a lot to do with the nature of the horizontal mill. The biggest feature is that the water was transferred from the mill pond to the waterway through this structure called a penstock, and it came out as a pressure jet, almost like a turbine. But from the very beginning of the construction of the mill, this had to be buried. So it was buried up to maybe 2 to 3 meters. So of course the mill was abandoned. They didn't dig it up. It's left there so we can come along, and it's discovered either by excavation or through agricultural improvement. The other great bias is the actual wheelhouse is underneath. It's like an undercroft. So when the mill goes out of production, it gets filled in and is preserved. And the other great thing as regards to dating is everyone in Ireland, apart from my Nendrum II, was built in wood, so with these fantastic oak beams, etc., so we could date it very precisely. Nendrum, many of you probably know, tremendous example, probably the best I would claim from standing remains of an early Irish monastery. That's a monastery of the 6th to the 8th century, but it's a multi-period site. This is a representation of how it probably looked like in the 10th century, but with elements of all those periods. Now, below, in the foreshore below, you see our two mills. This is the representation of the second mill. Now, I'll briefly mention circumstances of discovery. Second season of our Strangford Lough survey, we were walking around the lough, working the tides 4 hours every day. We came to Nendrum, and it was sort of believed that we knew all there was to know about the upstanding remains of Nendrum. We were intrigued by these things in the foreshore, hadn't a clue what they were. One had been scheduled as a fish trap, fish weir. We totally rejected that because by this time we'd gained enough foreshore experience on fish traps to see that this was in the wrong position, wouldn't have worked. Nobody had a clue what this was. Somebody in the past suggested it might have been a fish pond, but they weren't taken seriously. So we pleaded for funding for excavation, which we carried out, and discovered the two mills. Just upstanding, summary of upstanding archaeology of Nendrum itself. The remains of a stone church is probably early, I don't know if Thomas would agree, maybe 10th century. That is really sort of based on the depth of its ante projections that are about a metre wide, which suggests, Tom Manning suggests, that's an early feature that gets smaller. Splendid series of long cystic graves. Graves people probably know those. Later, around Tower, 11th, 11th century. Lovely series of this type of cross, hollowed armpits, which Megan showed some examples of this morning. That is comparatively rare in an Irish context. We get some, but not that many, and it's much more common here, Northumbria, in Scotland. In Ireland, it's become sort of known as the Nendrum type because we have about 20 examples from Nendrum, but not that many elsewhere. They were producing these as grave slabs. With a local distribution, it was obviously using the local shale, exploiting the foreshore, and had a workshop for them. The excavation produced loads of craft activities, bronze working, iron working, stone working, the scriptorium. Great criticism, it was dug too early, it was dug between 1922-24, as one person has represented it, Knoller dug it like a field of potatoes. But having said that, it still probably is the biggest collection of artifacts from an Irish monastery. Other examples of stonework is beautiful multi-marigold ornament. Main point here I want to make is that this was interpreted as a runic stone until the late giver Charles Edwards came along and immediately recognised it as sort of display capitals. Point I want to make here is that writing, we think writing is for holy writ, for monumental inscriptions, etc. But it's quite possible that it was used for accounting, for food render, and for crop yields, etc. So that's technological advance. Nendrum produced probably the best example in Ireland of a pre-Norman, of only about 10 pre-Norman sundials. This example from Nendrum. Their main function for canonical hours, ringing the time, but we've got the invention of time management and labour organisation, etc. So that bit of technology has an aside of an input. The engineer is like stuck on random here, so better speed up. First mill, firmly dated, the most firmly dated early medieval structure in Ireland, I would say, because we're about 22 dendrodates. Very, very precise. Felling started in spring 619. The oak used immediately, still has spring vessels, sapwood, etc. The construction ended in 621. So very precise, and we can actually, in the sequence, see that the start in the dam and move towards the mill. This was it before excavation. We took off these stones, which revealed an absolute complex, almost overkill. This is one of the great achievements of these tidal mills, the actual building of impermeable dams. It presented great, great problems. Here, they went overboard. About 110 metres long, 112, but 9 metres wide, and a whole series of different types of material used. Big oak beams, loads and loads of moss gathered from a forest floor, timber revetment and wattle fences, differential clays, blue clays, etc. And all this was underneath that spread of stones. Now, the tremendous thing about Nender is that with 2 mils separated by about 180 years, and that we can actually see the changes in technology in that short period, the great improvements that were made in milling technology and loads of other aspects. For lots of reasons, which I won't go into, the first mill was decommissioned and they built a splendid new mill in 789, date by Denver chronology again. Simplified it because they didn't realise they didn't need that massive dam, and they changed the direction so it wasn't facing the tide, etc., etc. Lots smaller volume water, but that was enough to sufficient as the old one. And everything converted to stone. Now in Ireland we think we didn't start building in stone much before the 10th century. This is the end of the 8th of building mills in stone. Nendham's the only one I know, but there's probably a lot more. They even converted, and this is totally unique in the world, they converted the penstock element to an actual to stone. Normally it was an oak, made from oak before that. The stone is very interesting because it comes from the very edge of the monastic estate, about 5 miles away. Small deposit of this pink limestone. This is the mill down behind. We tend to look at the high crosses in Ireland as our great symbol, our great icon of the early church. I would claim this penstock structure, if we're looking for an industrial icon, this is it. We've left that in situ, it's buried again, but it's a tremendous feature. Very quickly, one of the biggest changes was in water wheel design. Our first water wheel was represented by basically just flat boards. A type of water wheel that was known in the 19th century, it was used in Western Scotland, the Faroe Islands, China and places. And it was just these flat boards and the water hit it and it rotated. By the end of the 8th century, they developed this fantastically crafted water wheel with these beautiful paddles. Experiments have shown that this one is almost twice as efficient converter of energy than the first one. Millstones. This is the millstone of the second mill. They've gone about 25 miles away, sourced the millstone in the Moran Mountains. We've got it down to about 10 metres from where it's from. We don't know how it was brought to the site. We think probably by sea, because it'd be quite difficult to travel. There's a lovely passage, most of you know, in Cogitosa's Life of Bridget about the problems of transporting a millstone. And I think she had this miracle where the millstone rolled down the hill. Right position. The other great improvement is a big problem cereal growing in Western Britain and Ireland was that the wet summers, the grain at harvest time was full of moisture. You had to dry it before milling. One of the great advances in excavation during the Celtic Tiger was the discovery of corn kilns. Vast number found, and most of them quite early. We're talking about the 6th, 7th century. We have a splendid one that's a bit controversial, an endrum within the enclosure. This still exists. It was previously interpreted as a lime kiln. I'm nearly absolutely sure it's a corn drying kiln. They were open on the top, wattle at the top. This one has three flues, three fire pits. Dried your grain and stripped down the hill to the foreshore, to the mill. Very exciting in that we had all the key data. With the area of the mill pond, with the diameter of the orifice, with the jet come out, with the level of penstock intake, etc. So we could, and we the tidal range and the various readings, so we could work, get a fairly good firm idea of the extractable energy and the amount they're producing. And this is a very conservative estimate that coarsely milled barley, they would be capable of just about 50 tonnes per year, but it's probably a lot more. But the important thing was they could mill practically every day. The way it was designed, the second mill was designed that they could do almost two tithes a day. So it's a tremendous boost to bread making and food consumption. But the other big implication of this, that they're obviously, they're capable of processing grain far more than they're producing their home farm. So this must be coming from their estate and their dependencies. Cut a long story short, there's still a few copies of the book left. If you rush, you might get one. It's ridiculously cheap because it's very heavily subsidised by our NIEA, our local heritage body. And that, hopefully that'll answer the questions that I've left unanswered in my quick survey. So then to shift to what really we should be talking about is this reaching out beyond the mills and the technology to the impact on landscape. This is a reconstruction of the monastic estate at Nendham, which is quite small compared to other monastic estates. Like further up, we've got Bangor with a vast estate and Movilla. But they had other resources. If you look down here, you'll see that they had big expanses of foreshore. And the excavation showed that they were exploiting these very important oyster beds in this bay here. These were oyster beds go right back to the Mesolithic. They also had fish traps. So the maritime aspect of this monastery was quite strong. We think that the grain has been brought from the mainland. It's a tidal island. Tidal window twice a day, you can walk out to it. But the interesting thing was the mill was actually furnished with its own landing place, which was here. First, it was like a depth of six rows of logs and various other bits of timber. And we assume the grain was actually coming here and unloaded here. Second mill pair, they actually then put a stone covering and this and made it into a stone structure. Foreshore fishing, I want to say just a quick word about it. Strangford produced their survey a splendid series of stone fish traps, which nearly all were constructed by the Cistercians in the late 12th, early 13th century. The Lough had three important Cistercian monasteries, one founded from South Wales and two from Cumbria. They were maritime monasteries. But what they did was, as we were able to demonstrate, they just converted the pre-existing wooden ones to stone. Anytime we excavate a wooden one, we find stone one, we find wooden ones below. The dates all turned out 7th to the 10th century. So a big part of these monasteries, and Nendham in particular, was the exploitation of fishing and the development of very efficient fishing machines, basically get these foreshore fish traps. Could be just catch twice a day. It was only a matter of walking out at low water and getting the fish out before the birds got them. Tremendous. And this is a distribution of our traps, and I should have put them really on this map. And apart from, but I think one, they're all on demonstrable early medieval church land. So the church had a big input in developing foreshore resources and fishing. A quick sideline, but it's very pertinent to the landscape. It is clear from all the timber used in the first mill that it went through a massive forest clearance in the local area. And of course, that was not just to get timber for all their building activities. It was also to convert the land to arable. That corresponds to a pattern all over. It seems to start pre-Christian times, but if we can localize it, we can see in the proximity of a lot of the monasteries, this is intensified. Early medieval landscape. Right, we've got these great monasteries. We've got a great wealth of other settlement evidence in the early Christian landscape. How do we fit the church and isolate its contribution? The thing is the state structure of society. Early medieval, we tend to focus a bit too much on territories. What we really should be reconstructing are the states. Both the lay estates and the church estates. This is an attempt, and I would claim it's fairly accurate, of all the estates of the early medieval monasteries on the northern six dioceses of Ireland, and you can pick out some of the great monasteries that you know about, like Armagh, like Coleraine, like Bangor, and Movilla, and of course my little Nendham, and Down, and so on. So the church basically controlled up to a quarter, maybe a third of the landscape. This sort of evens out, Tomás, what you mentioned yesterday when you mentioned Matthew's church distribution. You know, if you look at through the states of the church, you can see where they're spread evenly across the landscape. There's some gaps in there are due to alienation of church land in Anglo-Norman times. So it expressed very quickly that Ireland always had a mixed farming system. Mills demonstrate the arable side of things, but animal husbandry, extremely important, especially in an Irish context, with this bias towards cattle, because our greatest crop is grass, and in the past, the exploitation of grass. And the Irish, as you know, didn't make hay until at least the 12th century. So what they did, they preserved the uplands. They grazed their great herds on the uplands during the summer, which preserved the lowland grass, and they brought the cattle down in the autumn, and they grazed all winter on this preserved lowland grass, then up again. This rhythm, transhumance building, we call it. Again, to study the church's influence on landscape, I would argue very strongly we have to do it through this estate structure. The farm level, which sometimes we can isolate from, say, the study of ring forts or other things, is too small, the territory is too big, And it's the state structure that will tell us the information. So we'll very quickly look at some of these monasteries. This is Armoy, not a great monastery, but a significant one. It's the major monastery of Irish Dalriada, claimed by Armagh in the tripartite life and to a lesser extent in Tirahan. Beautiful estate of 16 ton lands. It in essence displays what all these big monastic estates have, and that's this self-sufficiency in land types. It has a river flowing through it, and again, I would argue that most of these estates have a river flowing through them, so these small rivers weren't boundaries. You tend to think rivers as boundaries, only the major ones were. Very important to both sides of the river to control the fishing, etc. It had its lowlands, which were where the arable lands and the winter pastures were, but the important element they all needed was this upland summer pastures. And you see, on this estate, they have a sizable amount of land above 250 metres or so, beyond 600 feet in old money, here in Knocklade and Crocken. So one can see this movement of cattle up there during the summer, leaving the lowland landscape perhaps largely unenclosed, free from tramping cattle, and tremendous organization, estates management of resources. So within these estates, not only would they have the different land types for exploitation, but they would have their quantity of woodland for their pigs and for consumption, etc., and all their other needs. And they were organized, and the landscape was divided up to give them all self-sufficiency. This is their nearest neighbor, in fact, not a very nice neighbor, because we think it was claimed that Connor took over Armoy, 8th or 9th century. It's a few miles to the south. Again, if you look at this duality of land types, there's a river flowing through, but the land gobs stretches, the estate stretches from the valley bottom up to these uplands against self-sufficient estate, and no doubt exploited from the central point of the monastery, the estate headquarters. And I envisage there were mills throughout this, maybe quite a small number, but enough to process the grain in terms of food render or whatever from their tenants, the manai, to centralise in the monastery. And this was this I see as the great wealth of the Irish monasteries, their land wealth, not their craft activities, which of course supplied money, it's our currency, etc., but it was their land wealth. That's why they survived. The Viking invasions were no bother at all, knocked them back a few years, but if this land and wealth, the obvious recovered and went on. This is another one nearby, read about the Vikings, a few annalistic references, not that much. Became the seat of a bishopric in the 12th century, so it had a continued life for a short while after. Centrally located monastery. Again, this duality of land type stretches up to Carntaher here, down to the valley bottoms, the river flowing through it. And each one of these estates is capable of good analysis, the distribution of monuments within them and the distribution of church sites within them. And I've just finished a paper, it's not published yet, which shows they are the core of our 12th century reform in the creation of our parochial network. Clare, fantastic site, great time depth, Iron Age fort, Christianized royal site that became Christian, given to the church like many of them, probably to neutralize it. One of the early saints of the local royal dynasty. Again, a valley bottom to the mountaintop at the Sleeve Bay. And that pattern can repeat it all through these estates. Now, we go up a gear in that. Some monasteries, Armagh, preeminent monastery in Ireland, claimed as preeminent, claimed supremacy over all the churches in Ireland, or tried to. And if we look at its land wealth around Armagh itself, we can see that we're going beyond estate level, we're going on to territorial level, ecclesiastical lordship. And their estate, obviously divided into many subdivisions, stretched all the way from the Blackwater River in the north there, borders all the way to South Armagh, 30 miles in extent, about 10 miles wide. You can imagine the complexity of organizing a state like that. It must have been immense, and the land management. It's extremely interesting then, we've got a good pollen record from, just outside Armagh, from Loch Na Shade, This shows that at this period, the early period, very strong arable content, that there was great exploitation, which I interestingly started before the church ownership, but continued through it. So big economic union. And Niall has produced a very interesting paper where he's taken up the significance of these mills in that to get us beyond thinking of the early church, early medieval Ireland as having a subsistence economy to being able to have almost a market economy in grain. I would modify it slightly, but slightly disagree that I think the economy and the market economy sort of side of things, distribution was based in these estates rather than, you know, went any further. Another point, which is a point for debate, to stir the waters a bit, is I showed you, hopefully, the great technological innovations, achievements in milling. But that, according to Niall's work, which is very good evidence for it, it's not demonstrated in our plowing technology. That until quite late was still quite a simple plow. So maybe Niall, you'll say something that summing up, give us a later statement. So just to end, this is a sort of model of how these estates were organized. These large blocks of land, give you at the side here the scale of them, 800 to about 3,000 hectares on average, sometimes bigger, but big blocks of land. There's upland portion, lowland portion, are the different land types, and the central control under the church. Now, the lay estates we think were much the same, but I think the church pioneered this form of estate management. And then we have the mills were absolutely essential for regulating the food production. So if I could just go back briefly then to our distribution map of this sort of map. This is how I think we should proceed as regards analysing the church's contribution to the landscape and how it may have transformed at every one of those states. Hopefully we'll be subject at some time to proper analysis. Now this is a jigsaw at the moment, so for various parts like most of Tyrone and Derry, I have reconstructed the probable lay estates pre-12th century, so that you need the balance between the two. We need the whole estate geography before we can arrive at proper interpretation. So that's basically where I'm at the moment, and hopefully that is thrown something into the debate about transformation and the contribution of the church. Thank you very much.